What happens when people start losing jobs to AI?
It all depends on how quickly it happens. You never want a short kind of multi-decade human productivity. But on 5-year, 10-year timeframes, there are, you know, they're not magic. There's no way around it. That's rough.
Is there a chance this is the last debt cycle? Like, could this be the one that actually breaks the fiat system?
I think it could. The fiat system as we know it only goes back to the 70s. Commerce is happening globally. It's those intermediaries that have all the power. Until the dawn of Bitcoin, there was no fast settlement. And now we have alternatives.
Can this fiat system survive that?
We are already in the period where debt matters. The debasement's already happening. That's kind of the straw that breaks the camel's back. If people can't get to work, if they can't get the lights on, that's when you get revolution. This is like DEFCON 5. This is a catastrophe.
Lynn Alden in Bedford. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Did you enjoy Cheat Code yesterday?
I did, yeah. Always a great conference.
You did an amazing talk. And then we did a fireside all about the long-term debt cycle.
Yeah.
I think we should kind of go over the talk you did and then get into it.
Sure.
So I think you started this by talking about when the long-term debt cycle matters. Do you want to pick it up from there?
Sure. Yeah. I basically started out by saying that one of the most common questions I get, people ask, when will the debt matter mm-hmm. is what they ask. As though people have it, I think, in their head that there's like some day of reckoning where suddenly, you know, a treasury auction fails or some crazy thing happens.
I think I had this in my head.
Right. It's commonly what you think, because that's how many debts matter, right? Many, you know, if you have private debt, it often matters all at once. Mm-hmm. It's like doesn't matter until it does. Sovereign debt tends to work differently. It tends to be more of a process. So one of the arguments that I was making at the start of that talk was kind of saying that it has been mattering. Realistically, I would say it's somewhat mattered since the global financial crisis. But really, I would say since about 2018, 2019, I think it's been really mattering, which is to say that we're shifting more and more toward that kind of fiscally dominant environment. So it kind of reduces credit cycles because the U.S. deficits are so large, partially because of interest expense. And then in addition, you know, I think the populism that we're seeing in the U.S. and Europe especially, a lot of it does tie into basically these very top-heavy entitlement systems with slowing demographics, and that's basically a debt problem. And even things like war that we sometimes see with a number of steps can be potentially tied back to debt problems. That basically financial imbalances build up, and countries start making more extreme decisions in those contexts. So yeah, my view is that the debt has been mattering from a macro standpoint, even just from an investor standpoint. I mean, I use the phrase "nothing stops this train" in large part because we're running these 6-7% of GDP deficits, and a lot of it is so locked in because we already have so much debt, including so much interest expense on that debt. And mm-hmm. so a lot of it is just kind of on autopilot at this point.
So you say there's not like a moment that it matters. There's not going to be a failed treasury auction, which is the key moment. It's a process. But what happened, like when in 2008 or in 2018, 19, when did it start mattering? Like what happened that meant this started to become a problem?
Yeah, good question. I back up and say like there are moments where it matters more than others. Like I would say it's punctuated by many crises. In the UK, for example, the gilt crisis mm-hmm. in 2022. Like the Liz Truss moment.
Yeah.
That was like a moment where it mattered, but it wasn't like the apocalypse, right? It wasn't like the day it mattered all at once, but it was like a moment where the deficit were basically called out in a sense. And the US has kind of gone through similar moments. The reason I kind of point to 2018 or so is we started to see overall deficit spending was larger than total bank lending.
Okay.
In the country. And even when you add total bank lending and total net new bond issuance, so you're kind of taking a pretty big snapshot of private lending. And the U.S. deficit was like as big or bigger than all of that combined. So when you say, well, where's like net new money creation coming from? You know, in the 70s, in the 80s, in the 90s, in the 2000s, the answer would have been mostly from the private sector, even though the government was running deficits too. But once we got over 100% debt to GDP, so we have pretty substantial interest expense, And you know, we're running these entitlement systems that are kind of no longer mathematically as sound as they were decades ago. That combination of the demographics and the accumulated debt made it so that even in a non-recession year, so it used to be that only in kind of recessions would the deficit spending exceed like bank lending, because bank lending would contract in a recession, deficits would blow out in a recession. So you'd have these kind of brief moments, but this was like the first time where in a non-recession, just as a baseline, deficits are bigger than private bank lending. Like all banks in the US combined do have deficits bigger than all their net new loan creation. And so that starts kind of, it creates like a run it hot environment. So recessions start to feel different because you're almost pre-stimulating in a way before the recession would hit. You get more inflationary recessions. So at least less disinflationary recessions. Of course, COVID threw a whole wrench into everything. Mm-hmm. But even apart from that, just before COVID, we started entering that. And then even—
Is that when we had like the repo crisis in 2019?
That was a key moment. I think about a year before that, some of these signs were showing up. That's actually when I found Luke Gromans' work. Mm-hmm. He made very good calls about what was gonna happen. I looked into it at the time. And when the repo crisis happened, people were quite confused. Some people were like, the doomers were kind of naturally like, oh, there must be major banks failing and such. And then the kind of the establishment was like, no, it's a technical problem. It's no issue at all. And the view that I was taking at the time, the view that Luke was taking was, no, this is actually kind of tied to excessive debt issuance. That basically all these T-bills and debts were coming out. There were a bunch of other financial plumbing issues. But at the end of the day, basically the Fed had to go from balance sheet reduction to balance sheet increases, mm-hmm. despite no recession, just because they needed more liquidity with their own liquidity rules to account for like how much treasury securities were coming to market when foreigners were not buying enough, banks could only buy so much, insurance, like other kind of balance sheets could only buy so much. You add a couple other kind of topical factors on it that are kind of probably too wonky for this podcast. And you get this moment where the Fed has to step in and buy T-bills just because too many T-bills.
So when we obviously got COVID early 2020, and then there was the insane COVID stimulus, was that inevitable anyway, even if we hadn't have had COVID? Do you think they'd have had to step in and do something like that?
I do think so. And it's funny because like even like BlackRock had a paper out before COVID that was like, the next recession that happens, we're going to have to get more direct. Mm-hmm. We're going to have to do more like helicopter money type stuff to re-stimulate. Yeah. And I had even read an article in mid-2019 called, Is This a Bond Bubble? Or Are We in a Bond Bubble? Or Is This the New Normal? And it was a whole thing kind of like how bonds work. I was looking at the fact that there was now 18 trillion in negative yielding bonds in the world, mostly in Europe and Japan, let alone very low positive interest rates in the US. And I took the stance that this is a bubble. This is like, people always ask me if the stock market might crash. I was like, I'm far more worried about bonds at this time. And I even talked about it. I was like, people have gotten so used to disinflation, they don't realize that the next time we have a major recession, central banks and governments can do crazy things. Mm-hmm. Like I didn't have obviously COVID in my mind, but I was like, basically they can do much larger monetized, like they can always create inflation.
Yeah.
That they have no problem creating that if they want to. It's harder to stop inflation than it is to create inflation. My rule was kind of like—
The last few years have proved that.
You've proven that. But in 2019, that was a non-consensus view. Hmm. So then when it started to play out in 2020, I already had a lot of this mapped out. I mean, just from reading Ray Dalio's research and then kind of I would quantify it even kind of more than he did in a lot of his presentations. I would kind of go and double check the math myself and look at other avenues and try to disprove it. And really kind of made it my own research at that point. And so when all that COVID stuff hit, I was like, okay, this is bigger and sooner than I would have guessed. It didn't have to happen at that scale, but the numbers were already making it so that this was going to happen kind of one way or another over in the 2020s.
Do you want to pay less in taxes and stack more Bitcoin? Of course you do. Well, by mining Bitcoin with Blockware, you can. Under Section 168K of the US tax code, Bitcoin mining servers qualify for 100% bonus depreciation. This means every dollar you spend on miners can directly offset your income in a single year. And that's true for both business owners and W-2 earners. If you have $100,000 in ordinary income, you can purchase $100,000 in miners and potentially offset your tax liability entirely. Blockware's mining as a service does all the heavy lifting. They secure the rigs, they source the low-cost power, and they handle all the day-to-day maintenance. So you get to stack Bitcoin every single day while drastically shrinking your tax bill. Get started today at blockwaresolutions.com/WBD and use code WBD for $100 off your first miner. That's blockwaresolutions.com/WBD. Bitcoiners, as you know, with fiat money constantly debasing, wealth preservation isn't optional. That's why I recommend Swan Bitcoin, a team of dedicated Bitcoiners who work with families and businesses to build and secure generational wealth with Bitcoin. Strong relationships with clients are at the center of everything Swan does. A dedicated Swan Private Wealth representative, which is a real person that you can text and call, will help you build a Bitcoin wealth strategy using Swan's comprehensive platform of Bitcoin services, including tax advantage retirement accounts, advanced Bitcoin cold storage using collaborative self-custody, inheritance planning with both trust and entity accounts, tax loss harvesting, asset-backed loans, and more. Swan have helped over 100,000 clients since 2020, and if you're serious about acquiring and securing Bitcoin, I recommend Swan. Meet the team at swan.com/WBD, which is swan.com/WBD. The thing that keeps me up at night is the idea of a critical error with my Bitcoin cold storage, and this is where AnchorWatch comes in. With AnchorWatch, your Bitcoin is insured with your own A-plus rated Lloyd's of London insurance policy, and all Bitcoin is held in their time-locked multi-sig vaults. So you have the peace of mind knowing your Bitcoin is insured while not giving up custody. So whether you're worried about inheritance planning, rent tax, natural disasters, or just your own silly mistakes, you're protected by AnchorWatch. Rates for fully insured custody start as low as 0.55% and are available for individual and commercial customers located in the US. Speak to AnchorWatch for a quote, and for more details about your security options and coverage, visit anchorwatch.com today. That's anchorwatch.com.
So when you, like, obviously this has got worse since 2018, 2019. What are you worried about now? Like, what are the areas of the market that you're most concerned about?
Oh, entirely the Strait of Hormuz. Mm-hmm. People ask me, for example, if I'm worried about private credit. I mean, there's always little pockets to be worried about. Like, for example, in the 2023 regional bank crisis, literally the day, I think it was March 9th when it was kind of playing out, I just went on Twitter. I was like, I know it's like non-consensus at the moment, but most banks are going to be fine. Because this is like it was a specific bank issue. A handful of banks that were like had very specific issues that they ran into.
Yeah.
And most banks were fine. And very small amounts of tweaks were able to just kind of put that fire out.
What makes you think that? Because I did a show with your sparring partner, Jeff Snyder. I can't remember exactly when it was, but I think it was just before the war started. So to be fair, he didn't have that to sort of tie into this. But he was looking at private credit and thinking this might escalate into being a real issue. And he wasn't calling for financial crisis now, but he was like, this is something we need to pay attention to.
Well, I would agree with that phrasing. And I've even in my own research, I was like, I don't consider it an issue yet, but I mean, it's notable enough that I'm watching it, especially because if people are always asking about it, I want to be able to give them answers that are backed by analysis, not just kind of like off the cuff. But we need to quantify the size of private credit. So it's total bank lending to non-deposit financial institutions. It's otherwise known as shadow banks, which sounds scary. In some ways, they're less scary than normal banks because normal banks do fractional reserve bank lending. They take your checking account, like your demand deposits, if you're running a business, like literally your payroll account, and they go and make illiquid loans with it. And they just hope that not too many people withdraw at once. But because they are so risky, they're also highly regulated banks, especially after the global financial crisis. So shadow banks are entities that make loans, but they don't use depositor funds. Mm-hmm. And if anything, so it's mostly like high net worth investors, institutions that want a return, insurance companies, pensions, just large balance sheets, as well as just wealthy individuals will put money into this fund. And right up front, it'll say like, we can't guarantee liquidity. You know, this isn't a savings account. This is you're putting capital in and we're making loans with this capital. And we'll, you know, when you want to pull your money out, we'll try to accommodate that. But I mean, if too many people want it at the same time, you're gonna have to wait.
Tough luck.
Yeah. And that makes sense for savings, not for like a checking account or like, you know, near-term savings. Mm-hmm. So when they gate withdrawals, it's not nearly as bad as a company that whose like payroll, what do you mean it's not there? What do you mean I can't access that, right? Or what do you mean by checking account? So it's in some ways less scary, but the part that, of course, freaks people out is that it's one, it's more opaque, it's less regulated, They do generally engage in riskier types of lending than a regulated bank. And the kind of the cheat code, I guess, I'll use the word cheat code because where we are, is banks want exposure to that area, but they want risk-reduced exposure. So instead of lending to the types of entities, like these smaller businesses that might be recipients of private credit, banks will lend to the private credit fund, and then the private credit fund will go out and make loans.
Okay.
Now, the difference is the bank's not lending all the capital. So the private credit fund's mostly taking capital from investors, either, again, high net worth individuals or institutions. Mm-hmm. They're lending it out, but they're also borrowing from a bank for a smaller portion of their capital. And let's say they do make bad loans, because some of these are risky. Some of them are consumer loans, some of them are business loans. There's different specialties. And let's say they do start to go badly. The first people that get hurt are the investors, the ones that decided to put money in and they expected to make, say, 90% returns on these loans.
But that risk on them, that's kind of fine.
Yeah, and that's fine. I mean, it's not great. It around the margins, the negative wealth effect could hurt the economy, because if you had $1 billion in this fund and it got cut to 700 million, maybe you'll buy couple less cars that year. It can affect high net worth spending around the margins, but it's not a grave concern compared to like a true financial crisis. It would have to get so bad that they lose so many loans that even their bank loans, they have trouble paying back. Like they're more kind of front line creditor, not just the investors in the fund. And when you quantify the numbers, so banks in the US currently have $1.9 trillion in loans outstanding to all non-deposit financial institutions. And that sounds like a lot, but that's out of $25 trillion in total bank assets. So something like 7 or 8% of their assets, which of course their assets are someone else's liability, but of their assets, 7 or 8% is in non-deposit financial institutions. Of that, some of that is private equity, which actually has its own problems at the moment. So only a subset of that $1.9 trillion is private credit. It's a trillion and change. And let's say half of that were to just go away. Literally half of all private credit is defaults tomorrow. Well, first the investors take hundreds of billions in losses. Some of the worst hit funds then might start defaulting on the bank loans. But the amount of that gets through to the banks, the losses, we're talking, 100 billion. 200 billion?
Drop in the ocean.
300 billion? I mean, yeah, but they have 25 trillion assets and they have, their bank capital, the amount that their assets exceed their liabilities, it's well over 2 trillion. So while there might be individual banks, probably banks you never heard the name of, that suddenly we wake up and kind of like how Silicon Valley Bank had a very particular issue and a couple others along that, you could absolutely have a bank failure. But it won't be generally speaking, the ones that you know the names of.
Yeah. I mean, I even had that with Blue Owl was the one that I think Jeff Snyder was talking about. I'd never heard of that before. Like these are things that...
And it's a bellwether. It's a canary in the coal mine. Mm-hmm. It's, there's aren't headlines that are dismissible. So for example, when people ask, are you worried about private credit? I'd be like, well, if I was a private credit investor, I'd be worried about private credit.
Yeah.
What people are really asking is, can this tank the whole economy? Or can this contagion into the banking system? Those are the parts where my view is not that much, other than what if it's combined with other issues. Like I mentioned, the Strait of Hormuz, if we have an energy crisis that then has all these negative effects, and then on top of that, we have some private credit also, things can of course pile on to make a really bad outcome, but I don't view it as emanating from private credit per se. It's not truly big enough to be frightening in that sense.
That makes sense. I think when we were on stage yesterday, we were talking about the things that do frighten you. And you said when it gets to the issues, it's Strait of Hormuz is number 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah.
So obviously the energy crisis being a part of that, but what are the things that you're looking at there that concern you?
One is, 15 to 20% of global energy production is just offline, or at least can't get to where it has to go and then starts going offline. Some of it's damaged. It's not clear when it's going to reopen. It could, peace talks could break out a week from now, and then after some further weeks, we start getting things coming back online. So either way, it's going to take bare minimum weeks to get flows. But that could take months or longer. And there's no kind of viable alternatives to get that energy out. And really, energy shortages or food shortages are about the worst case scenario for any economy. And they often even go together because it's not just oil and gas going through the strait. It's also fertilizer inputs. I mean, natural gas is a major fertilizer input. Mm-hmm. There's also other urea, sulfur, helium. There are things that are, either for fertilizers or for electronics manufacturing or for even just medical equipment. There's tons of components.
So when you talk about oil, food production, medical equipment, electronics, it's like, it's everything.
It's everything. Yeah. And it's the foundation. It's like, you know, where the economy is based in upside down pyramid, mm-hmm. and that little tip is basically raw materials. And that's the part that's disrupted. Because if you have let's go back to private credit. Let's say you have a $500 billion hole just shows up in private credit. I mean, that's 3 months of like US deficit spending. Like that's like literally you can snap your fingers and make that problem go away, or just it's you know, we live in a fiat world. Mm-hmm. But when you have molecules that just can't get to where they have to go at that scale,
the Fed can't print oil.
Can't print oil. And it's not, you know, like it's funny because the oil analysts I follow, I purposely try to follow the non-sensationalist ones, the ones, you know, there's just like any field, there are perma bears, there are perma bulls, you yep. know. So the analysts I follow are not either of those. If anything, they probably lean more bearish because that seems to be in oil, the sensationalist ones are more like tend to be permables. Mm-hmm. Like all this is going to go wrong. We're going to get a massive,
same
and they're
Bitcoin.
Like, and they're always like, no, it's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. Well, this time all those, like my closest analysts I follow, they're always like, no, it's fine. They're like, okay, this one's not fine. this is like DEFCON 5. This is a catastrophe.
Yeah.
And everything I track says the same thing. So
how does it work? Because all the oil that's coming through the Strait of Hormuz generally, I think, is going to South Asia, Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
Obviously it affects the oil price globally.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have a direct impact on like production in the US or does it?
It doesn't have a direct impact on production in the US. If anything, if prices are higher for longer, it could encourage a little bit of shale oil to, mm-hmm. to come back online. So it could increase our production a little bit, but not 15 million barrels. I mean, it might be able to get another million barrels, not 15. And the complicated thing is not all oil is the same. You know, there's lighter crude, there's heavier crude, and then refiners are set up to refine a certain type of crude.
Yeah.
That's why even though like a country can produce as much oil as it consumes, it might still have to import and export because it might not be producing the right type for its own refineries, ironically. And that's like the US's case. Like you still have to trade. And so it is true that almost all the what comes out of that strait goes east. But especially the wealthier ones there can then bid for other sources of oil and liquefied natural gas in the world. And that's why it was 3 weeks into the war, gasoline in the US was up 30% or mm-hmm. more. Because it is like a global market. Some energy markets are more fungible than others. One of the least fungible will be natural gas because transporting it is so cost inexpensive. You either need a pipeline or you need liquefied natural gas, which is a very expensive like facility to freeze it, ship it, and then get it back into its gaseous form. There's a limited amount of LNG capacity, which means that when there are gas shortages, they last longer than like oil price differentials. So for example, when Europe had a gas shortage, gas prices in Europe were way higher than US gas prices and it lasted a very long time. And that delta is kind of always there because there's only so much LNG capacity that you can use to arbitrage that. Whereas oil markets, because it's easier to move oil around except for in extreme scenarios like this or similar ones, you can arbitrage spreads easier.
Okay.
But the point is that basically, and using like say 2022 as an example, when Europe had a natural gas shortage, they're wealthy enough to say, okay, we'll pay whatever we need to mm-hmm. keep the lights on, which means that like LNG that was like headed toward Pakistan would just get outbid and just go to Europe. And then Pakistan can't, you know, I'm using them as an example. They had other issues, but that was one of the issues they had that year. And so the poorer countries often just, they're the ones that actually end up with the true shortages. And I think we'll see a similar thing here, which is people will look at like Taiwan stockpiles or Japanese stockpiles. It's like, well, they're pretty wealthy. Mm-hmm. They've got a lot of options to bid pretty much whatever they need to keep the lights on. It's the developing countries in the world that I think are going to be the hardest hit, including South Asia, including Africa, parts of South America, where, you know, many parts.
I mean, you were saying again on stage yesterday that that's already happening in Egypt, where you spend a bit of time. They're having, are they going into sort of rolling blackouts?
Yeah, it's starting to happen, not just in Egypt, but elsewhere. So in Egypt, historically, because they've had energy issues in the past. They, like, for example, they built some ghost cities before they built like a nuclear power plant.
Done it the wrong way around.
If you're gonna at least do the power plant first. But anyway, so they had electricity shortages. But it shows up mostly in the summer months, mm-hmm. because you're in the desert, people use air condition. So in summers, they'd have rolling black brownouts. And what's happening this time is here in the spring, they're already planning to say, okay, like cafes are going to have to start shutting down at 9 p.m. A bunch of these kind of limiters, which is all these constraints on the economy, because their natural gas import bill tripled on a monthly basis. Is tripled. And it's a poor country on a per capita basis. So they just get outright shortages. And we're already seeing, I mean, there are countries in Southeast Asia that are kind of reporting similar things that are saying, you know, we're doing gasoline rationing. And it's those will just keep getting worse. Kind of starting mainly with the poorest countries.
So this might be a silly question after everything we've just spoken about, but when I had Luke Groman on the show recently, he was talking about oil at 100. I think he used the 130 as the benchmark. Oil above $130 is basically a catastrophe for the economy. When we were speaking last night, you said you think it can go far north of that. What is the constraint that puts on everything? Why is that such a big issue, aside from just like gas prices?
Yeah, so if the strait is closed for a prolonged period of time, it can go well above 130. And I don't know, the magic number changes over time just because mm-hmm. inflation, we keep growing the money supply. So $130 is not the same as $130 barrels, 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, when you do get to atypically high levels, the problem is that's a raw input. Mm-hmm. When you have, let's say, a private credit contagion, that's going to impact funds and things like that, people that have the spare capital. Gasoline impacts, there's consumers that are just, they're very constrained in terms of their spending. In the U.S., people have been suffering from higher food prices, higher insurance prices. I mean, even though the bulk of the price inflation is behind us, but it's still trickling out in these other categories. And the last thing they need is gasoline, 30% more expensive, let alone if it doubles, if it goes to record highs or something. There are many many households in the bottom two-thirds of the income stack that's a kind of a catastrophe if gasoline prices just double. Then you add businesses. So many businesses that are not like software companies, they operate on 10, 20% margins. Mm-hmm. And especially if they're moving things around a lot, energy is a huge component of that. So just business margins get eaten up by these energy inputs. And then, like I mentioned, natural gas is a huge input for fertilizer. And so you start to get a situation where farmers, their input costs have gone up substantially, which means they're going to have, they run into their own financial issues. If their crop prices don't go up quickly, so their inputs are going up, but not their exports, so they're getting squeezed. Mm-hmm. If that persists, of course, then the crop prices go up, which means food prices go up, which, again, if you're in the top 10% of a wealthy country, you might not even know, you might not even notice. But if you're in most people will notice, and especially if you're in a developing country, you'll absolutely notice. Mm-hmm. I mean, a large part of what caused the 2011 like Arab Spring, like the uprising in a number of countries, they were protesting against kind of dictatorial policies, but the catalyst was basically high food prices. That's kind of the straw that breaks the camel's back. If people can't get to work, if they can't get the lights on, if they can't get air conditioning on. That's when you get revolution. Yeah.
It's scary. You said earlier that the debt crisis was one of the things that played in or can play into potential wars like this. Yeah. How does that work?
It works in two ways. One is obviously war is expensive. So war leads to sovereign debt crises. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was true in World War I and World War II. But then also, very indebted sovereigns, especially if you're like the kind of incumbent, like hegemon, the empire, usually you don't kind of give up your borders, your influence, your scale. Usually you try to put that problem somewhere else. If you're a smaller country, maybe higher debt won't make you more belligerent because you don't really have the option too much. But if you're you know, the US or previously Britain, or, you know, before that and any number of empires, they tend to lash out when they start to have problems. And so they get feisty.
So it's classic fourth turning stuff where it just gets more and more volatile.
Yeah, it gets more and more volatile until it just kind of finally settles. Mm. And of course, like, it, you get more, on average, you get more polarized politics, you get more populist politics, and just, you just get, yeah, over time, you just more extreme decision making compared to times are good, business is normal. It's no, we need to make radical changes. And of course, whenever you have big imbalances growing in the economy, it's very easy to misdiagnose where the problems are coming from, who's causing it. Either just subconsciously, people, you know, most people don't wake up and they're not macro experts, and mm-hmm. you know, they don't know why a lot of this is happening. They have other jobs and other expertise, so they easily complain the wrong thing. And then politicians also can purposely target a group, an outsider or something, and say, this is happening to us. You'll see that a lot in developing countries when they have a currency crisis. They're like, no, it's the outside speculators that are breaking our currency. That's why we need to do capital controls.
Yeah.
And it's always some other entity's fault.
I mean, that's happening in developed countries too, though.
Yeah.
Like, it's blaming immigrants for, which, like, I'm not saying that we should have completely unfettered migration, but it's a very easy scapegoat when things aren't going great.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it plays into that kind of pattern, that mindset. And I think that another issue is that even some of the immigration policies we see, some of that ties back to the debt and demographics, because it depends on the country. Some of them chose to have looser immigration standards to try to fix their demographics problem. So mm-hmm. they would have these bloated entitlement systems that are very expensive. And when they were designed in the middle of the 20th century, it was kind of based on the idea that, you know, every generation is going to be bigger than the prior generation. Population is going to keep growing. So you always have plenty of young workers paying in to support the retired workers. But when birth rates slow down and people have fewer kids, you start to get very top-heavy demographics.
You got to bring people in.
You've got major issues. I mean, in the U.S., I mean, it used to be, you know, when Social Security came into being, it was like over 10 workers per retiree. And then it kind of steadied more at like 6 workers or 5 workers. It was like inching down. And it gets to the point where it's like 3 workers for every retiree. And it just becomes more and more imbalanced. So then policymakers say, well, maybe we shouldn't have a lot of immigrants. What could go wrong? You know, let's just do all this at once. And then, of course, that has its own ramifications. That has pushback. That leads to the populism. You're putting out one problem with potentially another problem. Mm-hmm. These problems they tend to cluster for a reason. Unfortunately.
If you haven't tried out Club Orange yet, then now is the time. It's my go-to place to find Bitcoiners whenever I'm traveling. Club Orange is a social app built for Bitcoiners where you can find meetups and events in your area and find merchants that are accepting Bitcoin. There are over 19,000 Bitcoiners on there, and whether you're at home or traveling, it's a great place to keep in touch with Bitcoiners from all over the world. I've been using Club Orange since it was Orange Pill app, and it really is awesome. So if you're on there, drop me a DM and say hi. And if you want to find out more and download the app, just search for Club Orange on your app store or go to cluborange.org. If you already self-custody Bitcoin, you know the deal with hardware wallets. Complex setups, clumsy interfaces, and a seed phrase that can be lost, stolen, or forgotten. Well, BitKey fixes that. BitKey is a multi-sig hardware wallet built by the team behind Square and Cash App. It packs a cryptographic recovery system and built-in inheritance feature into an intuitive, easy-to-use wallet with no seed phrase to sweat over. It's simple, secure self-custody without the stress. And Time named BitKey one of the best inventions of 2024. Get 20% off at bitkey.world when you use the code WBD. That's bitkey.world and use the code WBD. Do you wish you could access cash without selling your Bitcoin? Well, Ledger makes that possible. They're the global leader in Bitcoin-backed lending, and since 2018, they've issued over $9 billion in loans with a perfect record of protecting client assets. With Ledin, you get full custody loans with no credit checks or monthly repayments, just easy access to dollars without selling a single sat. Ledin exclusively offer Bitcoin-backed loans with all collateral held by Ledin directly or their funding partners. Your Bitcoin's never lent out to generate interest. I recently took out a loan with Ledin. The whole process was super easy. The application took me less than 15 minutes, and in a few hours, I had the dollars in my account. It was super smooth. So if you need cash, but you don't want to sell Bitcoin, head over to ledn.io/WBD and you'll get 0.25% off your first loan. That's ledn.io/WBD. Privacy was never a priority for mobile networks. For companies like AT&T, T-Mobile, and Verizon, data collection and monetization is the default. But CAPE is changing that. CAPE is a premium US mobile carrier with nationwide coverage designed from the ground up with privacy and security at the core. When you sign up, CAPE collects the absolute minimum data required, stores it for the shortest time possible, and never sells it. They also make you significantly harder to track at the network level and protect against SIM swap attacks, which are becoming one of the biggest security risks out there, especially for Bitcoiners. CAPE SIM swap protection is fundamentally different. Instead of usernames and passwords, your account is secured by a 24-word passphrase similar to how a Bitcoin wallet works. No one can initiate a SIM swap or take control of your phone number except you. This isn't a burner phone or a workaround. It's a normal mobile service built properly. If you care about privacy and security, there is no better mobile carrier. To learn more and get 33% off your first 6 months, head to cape.co/WBD and use code WBD at checkout. That's cape.co/WBD.
So in terms of getting out of the debt, there's really three levers. There's the idea of defaulting on the debt, inflate the debt away, or grow your way out of debt. Which do you think is the most likely of those three?
Combination of inflate and grow your way out.
They're never going to default.
I mean, almost never. Any country that can print its own currency will rarely ever default. There are obviously developing countries that owe debt denominated in dollars.
Yeah.
And sometimes the polite word is restructuring. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the polite word for defaulting. It's not saying you're not going to get it back. It's saying we're going to shift the terms around that you're going to get it back. That can default. Same thing with like the Eurozone. You can have bail-ins where, you thought you had money in the bank and now you have less money, but maybe you own shares of this now crippled bank, much diminished bank. So if the entity in question can't just unilaterally create its own currency, then default is an option, just like household debt, corporate debt. The main difference is that if you're a sovereign that prints its own currency,
why would you ever do that?
They rarely do. Mm-hmm. They almost never. And so instead, they debase their way out of it whenever they if they ever have a trouble with a bond auction, whenever they have a repo spike like 2019 or more recently, they expand the base money supply as needed, and so it defaults through purchasing power and inflation rather than through a nominal default. Mm-hmm. So in the U.S., for example, in World War II, the dollar was one of the least impaired currencies in the world. But even our currency, we had at one point 19% inflation, but we're doing yield curve control, so we're artificially holding treasury yields at 2.5% on the long end, lower on the short end, while inflation is 19%, money supply is growing dramatically, and so if you were holding currency or bonds,
crushed.
You're just crushed. You can buy less gold, less house, less food, anything that's kind of scarce or semi scarce. You're going to get less of it, and over the past, I talked before about that article, are we in a bond bubble?
Yeah.
We literally starting in from mid 2020 until the next 5 years, that was the worst 5-year stretch for developed world bonds, roughly in history, nominally, let alone purchasing power. And that's because we are already in the period where debt matters. The debasement's already happening. The reason growing out of it is a factor is because inflation feels less bad when it's partially offset by productivity growth. Mm-hmm. If we double the money supply, but we somehow use that money to build a bunch of power plants and manufacturing facilities and hospitals, and we keep prices down for a lot of things, it's kind of the MMT'er's dream.
Yep.
Then it'll still be inflationary for things we can't print more of, gold or Bitcoin or waterfront property or fine art, for example, but the things you're actively making more of won't feel as inflationary. If you're also benefiting from technological trends like Moore's Law, semiconductors are always getting cheaper, TVs are getting cheaper, computers are getting cheaper, peripherals, offshoring, automation. So plastic toys went down 95% in price from their peak and, textiles haven't gone anywhere in a long time. When all that's happening, the effects of inflation and debasement are more subtle. You start to see it show up in wealth concentration, things feel a little harder, but you can't put your finger on it because you're kind of on a treadmill that's semi-balanced. Where it really gets painful is when you have inflation without productivity growth. Mm-hmm. You know, like a war is a classic case of that because you're literally building stuff to break other productive things, and they're trying to break your productive things. So, for example, a closure of the Strait of Hormuz and then damage to energy facilities is a negative productivity shock because it's like all that stuff that was working and that was abundant is now less damaged and more expensive to get anywhere. And so policymakers, their kind of optimal scenario is, okay, we're going to run it mildly hot, and then we're going to hope that Moore's Law and AI and all these other things can, you know, let's say you grow money supply at 8% a year and you've got 4% better technology every year, and, you know, things would be 4% cheaper because of that. Instead, they're only 4% more expensive on average. Mm-hmm. They're like, 4%, the population will deal with that. That's kind of how they will think. So it's a combination of inflating and growing a way out.
And for the growth side, do you think that that is all kind of pinned on AI now? Is that their real only option?
That's the biggest one by far. I mean, for example, in the 1990s, so over the long arc of time, there's always kind of a delta between money supply growth and average price inflation. Mm-hmm. And it's because of that productivity amount. And some periods are more productive than others. And it depends on the country. So for example, in the UK, in the late 1800s, money supply and inflation were highly correlated because it was already a developed country. Whereas in the US, we had this like big untouched continent, more or less. Plenty of land, plenty of gold.
Yeah.
And so they could actually grow money supply quite a bit and not have it show up in prices because there were just fewer supply constraints. So we had a bigger than normal kind of gap there. There are other periods of time like Japan after World War II. I mean, they were just the most insanely productive kind of civilization for like several decades after that. It was like a huge kind of productivity miracle. Australia, with the rise of China, there was a long stretch where Australia had a bigger than normal money supply growth compared to inflation because you were getting all this investment from China and all this demand of commodities from China.
Yep.
And then in the whole developed world throughout the, especially the 90s and the 2000s, when you had the rise of offshoring, China, and just in general automation, so even domestic automation, they dramatically lowered the cost of manufacturing. And that was disinflationary. And where inflation showed up then was things that were not getting automated. So hospital services, education services, anything that required other workers in developed countries doing things for you in some way. That's the part that wasn't getting offset by those productivity growth. So you had kind of pockets of inflation and pockets of disinflation. Going forward, you know, we've already kind of optimized a lot of what we're going to get out of globalization, manufacturing automation, that sort of stuff, which means that kind of really the next realm to tackle is to try to make some of those white collar services less expensive, more you know, less human labor intensive. And so I do think that AI's, you know, it's kind of the next major thing where depending on how good that technology can get and how efficient it can be used, that can keep costs down. It obviously, you know, just like how manufacturing automation and offshoring had, you know, there were losers and winners from that because in the U.S. we had the Rust Belt, for example.
Yeah.
The U.K. has also at part of times been hollowed out industrially.
Definitely.
And so there's losers to it, but from a productivity growth standpoint, AI is kind of the main thing. Mm-hmm. There's no other clear area, at least to me, where we're going to get it rapidly better at making something other than kind of white collar services.
See, this is where I have a couple of worries, and I'm hoping you can kind of ease my fears on this, because the big question I have is at what cost? Because we are definitely, like, I think AI is going to increase productivity massively. I think it's going to replace a ton of white collar jobs. But what happens if that is the case? Because we saw, like you said, in the Rust Belt, when a load of jobs went over, like manufacturing jobs went over to China, essentially, that there was a huge opioid epidemic. It was like the economy of despair, essentially. Yeah. I think we could see something like that, but instead of it being the blue collar workers in the Rust Belt, it's going to be the white collar workers on the coasts. And then on top of that, that's question one. On top of that, what happens when people start losing jobs to AI? Because I don't think you need a huge proportion of the population to lose their jobs before you start seeing people defaulting on their debt, their mortgages, their car loans, all that stuff. And can this fiat system survive that?
Yeah, good question. So starting with the first one, it all depends on how quickly it happens. I mean, this has been a pattern going back really since kind of the dawn of hydrocarbons. Mm-hmm. So before then, population growth was pretty slow. Technological growth was pretty slow. The reason hydrocarbons accelerate everything is because, like, for example, a barrel of oil is the energy equivalent of thousands of hours of human labor. And it's just a enormous productivity boost. Once we got coal and then especially oil and gas, huge effect. And it started, like, for example, it depends on the area, but, you know, 2/3 of the population would work in farming or kind of close to farming. And that's just subsistence farming or near subsistence farming was kind of just the baseline. But when you have hydrocarbons and you have tractors and you have other kind of high-tech equipment, and this is, of course, high-tech a century ago or a century and a half ago, it allows vast majority of farmers to stop farming and to go do other things. They can go be engineers and doctors and accountants and, you know, the rest of civilization. So it ends up being that 2% of the population can feed everyone instead of half the population mm-hmm. having to do it. And of course, if that happens in 10 years, you've got a lot of out of employed farmers. But if that happens over a generation or two, it's an adjustment. It means that someone who was a farmer's son and was going to be a farmer instead goes to medical school. And it's most people would consider it a good thing. It's kind of like, okay, the next person will be kind of more educated and more able to travel and you know, generally do other things. But, you know, if it happens quickly, it can be disruptive. The same thing is generally true. I mean, you know, if it takes 20 people on a manufacturing line and you find ways to automate that and make it so you only have 2 people overseeing bots and fixing them sometimes and, you know, fixing edge cases and occasionally calling in a tech expert when you really need something help, that's a good thing. It's obviously bad if it happens in a 10-year stretch for people that can't retool their careers and change everything. So I think AI is no different, which is, you know, a lot of iterative tasks. We on average, we want to spend less time doing those.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, if you make your living from doing those things, that's disruptive. If you'd wake up one day and compared to 2 years ago, your services are just greatly devalued. That's there's no way around it. That's rough. But if it, you know, happens over a longer stretch, it's fine. And then even if it happens over a shorter stretch, there's an inevitability to it, which is you can put kind of artificial constraints on it, but it's just, it's like a jobs program at that point. It's like we have a cheaper way of doing things, but we have to kind of slow it down on purpose.
Yeah, but the genie's out of the bottle.
Genie's out of the bottle.
Yeah.
Yeah, Pandora's box is opened. And, you know, I still think there's, we don't know for sure how quickly this is going. Like, I'm an AI bull, but not like the super bullish kind. Like, there are people that, you'll see people kind of talk in their own book, like, oh, in 18 months, it's going to make all jobs useless or kind of these, and like, not really. There's obviously a lot of things that require conscious thought, and there are a lot of things that can be iterated on. And of course, the longer you look out, you never want a short kind of multi-decade human productivity. But on 5-year, 10-year timeframes, there are, you know, they're not magic.
Yeah, I don't think this is like an 18-month thing, but I could definitely see it happening in a decade. And that could also be too quick. And I think we saw in COVID when people were losing their jobs and they were like retrained as a computer programmer. Yeah. And now computer programmers are completely getting disrupted. Yeah. I find it hard to believe or hard to imagine the future where, you know, your 50-year-old accountant or lawyer has to retrain to become a plumber. Like that seems like a crazy timeline.
Yeah, I don't think that happens. I think, your second question was, how can this potentially impact like credit cycles and things like that? I mean, basically, so we've been under a 2-speed economy for a while. Mm-hmm. That's one of the kind of the risk factors when you have fiscal dominance. So in the US, for example, if you're an older American, you're on the receiving side of Social Security and healthcare. Obviously, there are richer older Americans, there are poorer older Americans, but on average, older Americans are richer and they're the recipient of bigger deficits. In addition, you know, if someone works in defense, and that's where a lot of our money's going. People on the receiving side of the deficits are generally doing well. Those that own assets that are getting inflated by all the deficit spending are generally doing well, whereas those who are not on the receiving side are generally the ones that are more struggling. And I think that AI is going to be, it's going to actually probably add fuel to that fire, which if someone is an earlier adopter of AI and is using AI to be more competitive than their peers or their competitors, then they'll probably view it as a good thing. If someone just wanted their status quo and they start getting disrupted by AI, I think it's going to be a rough time. And I think, I mean, kind of like how we see in the US and other places, you'll see wealthy people, and then a few blocks away, you'll see like tent cities. Like, I do think that there's that risk is going to keep happening, which is that there are some people that it just everything kind of aligns, and there are other people that just can't find an avenue to get a handle of things because they might have done an educational path and taken all the student debt, and then their income is now sharply reduced because of AI.
See, this is like, again, getting back to the debt cycle, this is where I see it as an inevitability that we have UBI at some point, because the social unrest, if we did have the rich suburbs next to tent cities, will be insane. And like you say, this is when revolutions happen. And so surely to kind of stem any of that, they're going to do something like UBI.
I think there's a good chance. I mean, you could have like a robot tax, you know, basically. Like, so yeah, the equivalent. Yeah. I think on a long enough timeline, that could become more commonplace. And I mean, Japan is an economy that's very interesting because they have the worst demographics issues roughly in the world. I mean, other ones are now kind of catching up, but they've had the long-term bad demographics.
Really aging population.
Aging population. Now, I mentioned before how some of these things tend to cascade into other issues. Mm-hmm. They've actually managed to mostly avoid the cascading problem. So they were highly productive for a long time. So they had huge trade surplus, which then turned into a current account surplus because they would, you know, they take all their capital and then they buy bonds and equity and commodity deposits and all these assets around the world. So they're getting interest and dividend income from the rest of the world. So they've kind of set up a financial fortress, even though they have a high sovereign debt in their own currency. They also have tons of assets.
So this is why they could have such high debt without really seeing inflation.
That's why they're an outlier. Mm-hmm. And then in addition, they early adopters of automation. I mean, they were kind of known for automation and, you know, robotics and things like that. And then they also have a very kind of harmonious society. And they didn't fall into the pattern of saying, well, let's fix our demographics issues by dramatically increasing our immigration. And so they just said, we're going to just tank this issue. They also did things like, I mean, even though they're older than the average American or the average Brit, they spend way less money per capita on healthcare and yet live longer. So there's social aspects there. There's also how they structure their healthcare system. They've had very low military spending for a long time. So they're running on average pretty substantial deficits, not as big as people think, but they've been running fairly large deficits. But they actually go back to the people. Their deficits are just going into healthcare, going into to kind of well-being. And it's not, I mean, obviously Japan has it's known for workaholicism, not very productive corporate sector in terms of like how many hours worked versus output. Mm-hmm. When you look at like quality of life or happiness ratings, they tend not to be near the top, like say some of the Nordic countries are.
Those two seem very aligned.
Yeah. they've avoided a lot of the crises that you'd otherwise expect when you're 15 years. I mean, they're further into fiscal dominance than any other country. Mm-hmm. And that just kind of shows that, it's a combination of debasement and then trying to keep the wheels on the car in terms of productivity growth. I mean, they've managed their energy policy pretty well. They haven't made any crazy decisions around energy. The things can be softened when there's a social contract in place and people kind of feel part of a nation that they're not just being, that it's not like one side is just kind of screwing over another side. I guess if things get more automated, certainly from the left side of politics, you're going to get more and more calls for UBI, and it'll probably be more and more enticing to a largest share of the population should some of these AI technologies keep taking off as the polls expect.
Yeah. And then what does that do to the debt crisis? Because we've had debt cycles in the past. You've talked a lot about the 40s and comparing now to the 40s. Is there a chance this is the last debt cycle? Like, could this be the one that actually breaks the fiat system?
I think it could. I mean, the funny thing is the fiat system as we know it only goes back to the 70s.
Hmm.
I think if we go back a little further, we can say it kind of goes back to the dawn of the telecommunications age. Because I talk about this a lot in Broken Money,
yeah,
which is for most of human history, like information couldn't really go faster than humans could get somewhere. So by foot, by horses, by ships, the fastest you could do is like, you know, birds or like fires in the night or something, but that's not high bandwidth. So you were kind of constrained. Once we had the telegraph, so it was invented in, say, the 1830s. It wasn't widely deployed, like cross ocean, until like the 1860s. You started to be able to share fairly high bandwidth information around the world. By the time it wasn't until the early 1900s, you were going across the Pacific, and at that point, you could do transactions at the speed of light, but not settlements.
Mm-hmm.
You know, settlements. How do you do irreversible value transfer? Well, you ship gold. And you audit and insure the gold and that, you know, it's a whole expensive, lengthy process. And that delta, that mismatch between fast transactions and slow settlements was like a godsend to the banks and the central banks. They said, oh, you need a middleman. It centralizes all the money. It's like, it's a massive tailwind for the money centralizers.
Mm-hmm.
Before, it's not that banks didn't exist before then. It's not even that central banks didn't exist before then in some cases. It's that their services are more optional. Because you can still just literally hand a coin to someone but when you literally are doing when commerce is happening globally, and most money's slow, it's those intermediaries that have all the power, and so from literally the dawn of the telegraph until the dawn of Bitcoin, there was no fast settlement, and then so Bitcoin gets developed, and then even then, of course, it's worth nothing. It has no network effect. It's a novelty. So even, you know, for the first, say, decade of its life, it wasn't moving the needle at all. Even today, it's now increasingly part of the conversation, but it's still a small asset in the grand scheme of things. But basically, I would say that we've reached the height of fiat currency in the sense that we've been in this period of time where there was no alternative between fast transactions and slow settlements. And now we have alternatives. And then while fiat currencies enjoyed that kind of monopoly on what works, they broke all their ledgers. They bloated their entitlement systems. They built kind of social insurance with the idea that every generation is going to be as bigger than the prior one. And all those things are kind of coming home to roost. So I do think that, one, I think this cycle will last a lot longer than people think. I mean, that's part of why I use Nothing Stops This Train. There's two sides of it. One is, no matter all these attempts that are going to try to reduce the deficit spending, they're almost all going to fail. So people were really excited about Doge. I was like, nope, here's why. Didn't even move the needle. So it's, on one sense, it's bearish, but it's also saying, it's also the wheels are going to be on the cart longer than you think, just because I think this is going to be a very stretched out cycle.
So how long do people think it's going to last? And how long do you think it's going to last?
I mean, there were people that thought the global financial crisis was going to break it all.
Mm-hmm.
There were people that thought COVID was going to break it all. There are people that every crisis, when the regional bank crisis happened, like, this is it. And, you know, it's always like next year or next, you know, 5 years. I mean, I there's only so far you can look out, because like literally you can have political structures be entirely different in, say, the 2040s.
Yeah.
You know, so I look out something like a decade. In the U.S., for example, that's when our Social Security trust fund, technically the surplus runs out. We've got something like a $3 trillion surplus in there just from prior overpayments. That's now in draining mode because we're very top heavy. And then either Congress has to kind of say, well, all retirees are now going to get, you know, 80 cents on the dollar or 75 cents on the dollar, or we're going to print the difference.
That's, I know, kind of which one that won't be.
Probably, yeah. But that actually requires a decision at that point, because it's kind of a separate pool of money. So it'd be interesting to monitor. And I mean, the political discourse around that time is going to be like lit.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I look mostly into the 2030s and say nothing really seems like it's going to slow this down anytime in that investable time frame. Look, you look out further than that and you get the science fiction.
Muddy.
Yeah, so.
Science fiction. We will get onto that. So if this is going to take longer, what should people be doing now to protect themselves through this?
Well, one, I mean, for people that have the luxury, it's making sure you're living in a spot that you're comfortable with, either in terms of the political structures, the social structures, all the things that you somewhat can control. On average, wealthier people have more optionality there than people that are lower on the income stack. Trying to make sure either your job is AI resistant or that you're using AI, mm-hmm. That you're not just kind of ignoring the trend, that you're trying to use the tools to be as competitive as you can be.
Yeah.
Owning where possible scarce assets and trying to avoid bubbles, because even scarce assets can have 5-10 years of price declines if they were bid up into a manic bubble.
Is this gold that you're really talking about here?
I think gold was overbought. I hesitate to call it a bubble because if we do have a long-term popping of like the whole sovereign debt crisis, gold has to get pretty insane numbers to like truly have like a 10-year loss, like a lost decade. But I mean, gold had a lost decade really after 2011. It got bid up to high levels. And I think it's obviously taking a breather now for a period of time. But for example, I use Costco stock as an example. It's like people look at it as like the most bulletproof company in the world. It's one of the few companies where like employees generally like it, customers like it, and investors like it. Mm-hmm. Usually you only get one or two out of the three. Somehow they,
It's the trifecta.
It's the trifecta. A lot of it probably rests on the hot dog. But Costco trades like 50 times earnings.
Crazy.
For a 40 plus year old blue chip retailer. They trade it.
Yeah, that's 50, like tech stock valuations.
Yeah, tech stock valuations. So nothing stops that from one day going down to 25 times earnings, mm-hmm. which is still actually rich. That's still a premium multiple. And it doesn't have to happen all at once. A really good example is in the late 90s, we think of it as the tech bubble. But for example, Walmart was trading at 50 times earnings. Coca-Cola is trading at 50 times earnings. They had very good growth in the 90s. And over like the next 10, 15 years, their stock prices basically just went sideways. Sideways can be up 20%, down 30%, up. It's not literally sideways, but it was just a chop solidation for like 10, 15 years while their earnings would double or triple until literally through time, they'd be trading at 20 something times earnings. Mm. And that could absolutely happen to stocks today that look like Costco, or like a couple years ago. I mean, recently we've had sell-offs in the Mag 7. These high quality companies that in some cases people were paying really high multiples for. Their fundamentals are still doing fine in many cases, but especially with CapEx and AI, they've been running into frictions. So the point of all that is whether it's gold, whether it's high quality real estate, whether it's high quality equities, those are generally things you want to own, obviously Bitcoin as well. And just you just want to be careful of your enthusiasm when you're buying it. When it's just all over social media, when it's at historically high valuations, that's when you generally want to have a pause and say, okay, even though there's money printing, can this thing still have 5 or 10 years of being dead money? But basically buying scarce assets at reasonable prices, trying to manage your location if possible, trying to make sure you're on the right side of trends where possible.
So there's obviously, I'm sure a lot of the people listening are psychos like me that are just basically 100% Bitcoin. But for an average portfolio, how heavily would you weight Bitcoin in it?
So for a lot of people, they have like 0 or 1%. Mm-hmm. So, I say, well, I think zero is the wrong number.
Yeah.
That's kind of my kind of baseline is like, there's a lot of numbers that can make sense. Zero is not really one of them, I think. Mm-hmm. So it starts by getting off zero. I think 5% is reasonable. I mean, it's funny. If you look at portfolios, gold has been underweighted in portfolios for a long time, despite a lot of evidence showing how useful it is for portfolios, especially replacing some of the bond component. So my view is always have more gold than like the baseline, which is almost nothing in a typical kind of managed portfolio. And with Bitcoin, I mean, I was early to put, say, 5 or 10% in. Now, in my personal like holdings, I hold cold storage Bitcoin. I do venture in Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's obviously much higher than that 5 to 10%, especially if you go through a couple cycles and you don't really sell, you just buy.
It just becomes higher.
But the way I kind of look at it is like, I think 5% can make a lot of sense. And then if someone, you know, if they do a podcast circuit and, you know, listen to like your show and other shows, and then they read the books and they spend a, 500 hours in the space. I mean, they know maybe they might want to dial that number up, but they're the ones that know when to do that. Not me telling them that they want to do that.
Yeah, that's fair. Last question on this before we move on to some other stuff. We've spoken in the past and you said your base case was that we were going to have money printing, but it was going to be sort of gradual money printing that was sort of aligned with GDP growth.
Yeah.
Does this war in Iran change that?
The short answer is potentially. So I started pointing out the gradual print scenario. I mean, in my research service over the past couple of years, I've been kind of aiming that roughly in this 2025 period, we would have had it. And that was actually the Fed's own projections roughly too. It was one of the few times I agree with the Fed. Because a lot of it was just kind of pretty like unavoidable math. Mm-hmm. And so when we got to late 2025, we started to get that gradual print scenario. It started to kick in December. So we're actually a few months into the gradual print now in spring of 2026. So Iran war aside, that's the baseline, is that they're growing in the US, they're growing the base money supply roughly in line so that it's a pretty standard percent of GDP. And they're not trying to do that to stimulate, they're trying to do that to keep fractions or bank lending, just the wheels, just kick the can down the road indefinitely. The war in Iran, it doesn't immediately threaten that, but if it stays closed for months and you start to get, if gasoline in the US doubles and other countries just, I mean, like Egypt starts to shut off at 9 p.m. every night, and the Philippines is gas rationing, and Europe, is freaking out. If it's just across the board, if there's economic turmoil, you could start seeing, on average, rising U.S. deficits. And then the central bank, it can run into liquidity issues, and they have to kind of up their expected rate of money supply growth to kind of keep the treasury market functioning, to keep the interbank lending market functioning. And then it comes down to, will a highly polarized Congress agree on a stimulus, especially for a war we began, mm-hmm. right? That's tricky. It's like, oh, hey, your gasoline prices are high because we initiated a war, but here's a gasoline stimmy,
Yeah.
That's good luck getting that through Congress. And so there are certain like kind of binary decisions at that point that I'm not going to try to predict what, even because not even being tabled in Congress yet, really.
Yeah.
But the first step is to just, if asset prices struggle, if consumers struggle, if the economy struggles, all of that impacts tax receipts, and that starts to widen the deficits. Do you start to inch out of a potential gradual print scenario? But I don't think we're there yet.
Very interesting. Can we do something a bit different?
Sure.
Because we've done, I don't know, on What Bitcoin Did, you must have been on 25 times or something crazy like that. And I don't think we've ever really talked about you. It's always about macro. And when we were at dinner last night, you've got a pretty crazy story. Like, everyone knows you as, one of the best macro analysts in the world, but you came from very little. Can you talk about your childhood?
I mean, it's a lot. yeah, I think there's a couple podcasts where it's come up, but he says not use something I kind of talk about a ton. I mean, I was homeless for a few years as a kid, and then grew up in a trailer park is kind of the short of it.
So how old were you when you were homeless?
Roughly 4 to 7.
That's crazy.
Give or take.
And so you were were you living literally on the street when you were homeless?
So it started out, first we were living with my aunt. Then we left and we were living in a homeless shelter and a couple different homeless shelters. Then we lived in a motel, like a cheap motel. And then at the last stretch, we were living in a car, and like we would, for example, to bathe, we would sneak into a public restroom at crack of dawn before anyone's there and clean ourselves off. So not quite like street, but if you're in a car, and it wasn't like a camper, it was like a sedan. Like, so yeah, living in a sedan.
It's whenever you like look back at your childhood, like I had a great childhood, very privileged. But I think you always look back on it and you remember the good times. Are there any parts you look back on that fondly?
Well, some, like when we were in the homeless shelters, especially because we were in two different states. The first phase of it wasn't that bad. It wasn't a very crowded shelter. There were other kids there. And so it didn't feel that normal from a kid's perspective. You can, like, kids don't need a ton if they feel safe.
And did you feel safe?
I did feel safe. That's the thing. I felt safe at that time. Wasn't like actively, never got to the point where I didn't have enough to eat, mm-hmm. right? So it wasn't like third world poverty. It was like developed world homelessness, and not the most extreme kind. It was certainly workable. I think the bigger issue was conflict between my parents. That's the part that a kid gets kind of tuned in on, not necessarily the physical stuff. Once we kind of got into the motel and then the especially the car, that's when it becomes a lot less, even for a kid, a lot less fun.
And is this why you got into MMA? Was it like an idea of defending yourself while you were living in these places?
That might have been part of it. I think it's actually contributed to why I got into investing, because from my, when I went to go, so all that homelessness, I was living with my mother. Mm-hmm. It got so bad that I went to go live with my elderly father in his trailer. And from that point on, I was like a super saver. Like if I got Christmas money or I got Easter money or I got allowance, I would save it. I even got into precious metal collecting, like literally as a kid.
No way.
Yeah, little silver coins and eventually like little like 1/10 ounce or up to like a 1/2 ounce gold coin. This is back when gold was only like $300 an ounce. So I was like a little bit of a coin collector. I could have told you about inflation back then.
No
like,
way.
Yeah, I was just, for whatever reason.
Did you keep any of those coins as like a memento from then?
I held them until 2011. It was the only time I ever sold physical precious metal because it was like a bubble. So I actually sold my precious metal collection then. I eventually rebuilt it much larger, but for years I had coins, and then I got into, when I was a teenager, got into equity investing. And I think a lot of that was because I went through this period of instability. So I think the pendulum for me, you know, like how people in the Great Depression, to use a more extreme example, like you'll have like a grand, like especially in the US, we'll have like a grandparent that like saves the rubber bands mm-hmm. or like never throws anything out, is super economical because they lived through the Great Depression or they were a kid through the Great Depression. So it's kind of got imprinted on them.
Waste not, want not.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I never developed that tendency, but I did develop like a high savings tendency from literally childhood. I think in part because I was used to chaos and wanted less chaos.
And so how do you go from there to, you know, going through college expensive in America? Like what happened there?
So my dad helped with the first year of college. After that, it was all student debt and part-time jobs. So I had to work my way through college, which is, I mean, it's especially if you're doing an engineering program. I mean, they're not easy. Mm-hmm. So it's like I was envious of the kids. They could just, you know, it was all covered for them. They had no debt.
Yeah.
For me, it always kind of felt like I was on a timeline. I always had to, you know, try to find time for it. But yeah, I was working my way through college, graduated, got a job, had $50,000 in debt, which, I mean, today is probably the equivalent of like $90,000 in debt.
Yeah.
Like it was equivalent to like basically a full year's gross pay. But of course, when you factor in your own expenses and everything, that takes many, many years to pay off. So then I just over time gradually paid off the student loans while continuing to invest and just kind of snowballed.
So if, as someone who was investing from really young, why did you not go into that as a field? Why did you choose to go into engineering?
I was torn. When I came down to university, I was like either finance or engineering. I had always in school, I'd always been interested in kind of the math and science classes. And for whatever reason, it was kind of arbitrary. I just had picked engineering. But then over time I found out that my heart was in finance. Like for example, there were like other kids and other students in university. They'd already been like building circuits and stuff in like high school. And I was like, oh, you're like a real engineer. I'm just showing up. Like, so I never was like a hardcore, like super engineer. Mm-hmm. When I eventually graduated, you know, like for me, it was engineering. Like we were building aircraft simulators, but from the beginning, I kind of realized I want to do a hybrid approach. I want to be an engineer, but I would eventually want to get like, say, maybe a master's in business, and then be like a manager of engineers or managing the finances of like an engineering facility. The kind of the hybrid technical decision and kind of more business, that hybrid. So I said, okay, I'm a decent engineer, but I'm not the type of engineer that's like clearly born to be an engineer.
Okay.
They're just absolute psychos. And I'm like, I'm good, but I'm not like a psycho. But like I was the kid that was like watching, like I could, when I was like 8, I could tell you what the Nikkei was, you know, and like what the price level was of the Nikkei. Cause I would watch the financial section of news. I was like that kind of psycho. So I was like, okay, clearly I have to get more into finance. So in my engineering job, I gradually transitioned it toward managing engineers and running the finances of the engineering facility, making kind of big technical financial decisions. While I was writing about investing in the early kind of blogging days of the internet, and I had like a little blog about stocks, and I eventually sold it to a larger publisher. And then at some point I started lynnalden.com, and it just grew so big I had to leave my engineering work.
Why do you think there's such a crossover between Bitcoin and engineers? Like Michael Saylor's an engineer, you are, checkmate. I'm sure there's a ton of others that I can't think of, but there seems to be a real crossover there.
I think because Bitcoin is a hybrid of finance and tech. I mean, in order to assess it, you have to have at least a decent understanding of its tech. You know, if you're comparing, one is, can this thing even work? Two, okay, now there's thousands of altcoins and they're all claiming to be the next Bitcoin or better than Bitcoin, or they fix, you know, Bitcoin's too slow. We have to,
yeah.
So you have to be able to set, okay, what are the trade-offs then? How do network effects and protocols historically develop? What are these other coins sacrificing to be quote unquote faster, more programmable and all this? That requires some degree of technical knowledge. So it's an inherently multidisciplined field. So engineers that also like finance is kind of the perfect background to find Bitcoin and sort of appreciate it.
And I think I'm right in saying you first started writing about Bitcoin in like 2017, is that right?
That was the first article, yeah.
But you weren't really all in Bitcoin in a sense until maybe 2020, 2021, is that right?
It was the 2019-2020 period, yeah. Okay. So I wrote about it in 2017, and by that point I was convinced on the fundamentals. Mm-hmm. I had two main hangups at the time. One was I wasn't sure that the network effects would be strong enough so that, okay, there's Bitcoin. That was also when Bitcoin Cash was, and I hadn't done like 1,000 hours on that. Ethereum was really big. And I was like, I don't know 5 years from now what the market share, how fractured the market share is going to be with all these different coins. So that was number one. And number two, I was like, okay, in late 2017, I'm like, this is a bubble. You know, it might not be the end of the world bubble, but this is very euphoric pricing. So I was like, interesting tech, not going to touch it. But what I did was that so before that I had watched prior cycles. I saw like I knew someone who mined it in 2010 and I was like, oh, that's neat. It's super cool. But I don't know. I was always like, I should look more into that. I was never like dismissive. I was like, oh, that's neat. I should look more into that. I just don't. And then cycle comes and goes. And then there was like the 2013 kind of cycle. And I was like, oh, it's like the cool, like libertarian money. That's, you know, it's, I hope they do well. And I just kind of didn't follow. Yeah. I didn't follow up on it. But in 2017, when we had that kind of third, it was like my third kind of awareness. I was like, I'm not going to just forget about it this time. Mm-hmm. So then I was correct. And it did have a big correction. It did do a long stretch of underperforming most other assets. But I watched the block size war play out. I kind of kept thinking about how to analyze, how to value it. And so by 2019, I started to get pretty convinced. And I was kind of like, but what's a good entry? And then COVID happened. And I was like, well, that's my entry. So
I mean, that's a pretty good entry. Yeah, that's still my proudest buy. I think it was March 9th, 2020.
Yeah, that's good.
When everyone was panicking. I got it in
April. So it hit the bottom and it was coming back up. And because I had a long stretch of history of kind of investing in precious metals, I mean, silver had a big drop, gold had a big drop, a smaller drop than silver, but silver was like a really brutal, and Bitcoin was behaving just like them. So when they kind of the V-shape happened, I was like, I see, like I could sell it where this was going to go. So I got in pretty heavily in April and afterward.
When you see your friends from the engineering days, are they weirded out that you're this like macro superstar now?
I don't think so. I mean, you always see people you know the same way. Mm-hmm. And also we're in kind of a bubble. Like, you know, it's funny to them that they can see me on YouTube everywhere and like crazy number of followers on social media and stuff. But we're, you know, people outside of our niche, you know, we're like little micro celebrities, you know, so yeah.
I think you're kind of outside the niche though. You're in multiple niches at least.
Multiple, but yeah, I mean, it's, I think they find it interesting. Yeah. But yeah, it doesn't, you know, it's just nice catching up with them.
And when did sci-fi come into this?
Oh yeah.
We got to plug the new book.
I'm plug sure the new book, sci-fi, The Stolgard Incident. I wrote a sci-fi book.
I told you I've started reading this, but I need to read it when I'm not going to bed so I can actually concentrate.
Yeah, it's not one of those like light like beach reads.
No,
it's pretty dark and pretty. But I've long been interested in the kind of fiction, and the story idea for that, it's been in my head for well over a decade. But I was like, when am I possibly going to find time? Because I was like working in engineering while also on the side writing about investing. And then eventually that took off. I got into venture investing with Ego Death Capital. I sit on boards of companies. I'm like, when am I possibly going to find time to write? But in 2024, I wanted to just kind of improve work-life balance a little bit. And then also just because of just kind of logistics, I had a little bit more time in the evenings for a period of time. And so I finally was like, you know what? I'm actually going to write the thing that's been distracting in my head for quite a while. So,
did you use AI at all to write it?
Nope.
All your hard work. That's the way.
Just me. I used AI as like a research assistant.
Mm-hmm.
So I would, like, for example, VR, virtual reality is in there, or gene editing, or like how good will batteries look in 50 years, right? Like I have an engineering background, but I mean, it's a multidisciplined thing. So I would say like, okay, what is like, here's my conception of VR in the 2070s. What do you think of this? And the AI would, you know, give me its analysis or like how energy dense could batteries be in the 2070s and what type of batteries are they likely to be?
Mm-hmm.
Or here's this laser design. Does this make sense? So it was like a useful, it was kind of a second search engine or a research assistant. Sometimes I would give it a chapter and be like, what do you think of these characters? Like do an analysis of this chapter or something like that. Just kind of see, almost like a beta reader. Or I would say, do you see any, you know, proofread this? Do you see any like obvious errors?
Mm-hmm.
Like I still gave it to human editors, but it's like, I don't, you know.
It's like the first cut.
Yeah, the less time editors have to find periods and you know, misspellings, the more time they can focus on substance, so.
It's funny. I was excited to read this book anyway, but we were at dinner the other night with Eric Herzman and I was going down my Matthew Pines conspiracy crazy shit. And every time I mentioned something, you were like, read the book. So I'm very excited now. I say on behalf of everyone, it's really annoying that you can just do everything.
I can't do everything.
Like, how do you just pump out what I'm sure is an incredible sci-fi book? How long did it take you?
So actually the funny thing with both this and Broken Money is the actual writing process was very quick, because with Broken Money, I had been thinking about doing a book for a while, but books are super tedious. Nobody should really write books for money. If you work in finance, like books are not where money is.
It's not a good investment.
Not a good investment. So my strategy was, don't write a book unless you feel like you have to.
Mm-hmm.
And with Broken Money, like the pillars, the core concepts just built in my head so much, the book was there and it became more distracting not to write it.
Okay.
Like I had to just get it out. So by the time I actually go to write it, it took 6 months to write it and another 6 months of polishing it. And literally within a year, Broken Money's out and it's rather polished 500-page finance book, but it's based on years of research. But the actual process was actually surprisingly quick. And I was so passionate about it that it was like just hours and hours of like late night just grinding, and it just kind of came together very quickly, like a fire hose. And this was kind of the same way, which was, the first draft was little over 2 months to write a 400 plus page book. I added a couple more chapters in like the month or two after that. But then actually that took a longer refining process than even Broken Money, because fiction is not my expertise. So that went through, Broken Money, it went through fewer rounds of editing and fewer beta readers because I was more sure of it from the beginning.
Mm.
This was like writing exactly in my area of knowledge. So other than a handful of people seeing it, I just knew it would go out and just kind of, people would experience it the way I experienced it. Whereas this one, because it's fiction, I was like, I have to get more eyes on this. I have to go through more iterations. I have to have editors that can make sure that my prose is like in line with genre conventions and things like that. So it was a shorter writing period, but then a very like a year plus long revision period.
Which one was more enjoyable to write?
Actually, equal. They both of them, what they had in common was that they both consumed me when I was writing them. They like, I wanted to like get other work done so that I could like work on my book that night for both cases. Yeah.
So if anyone is interested, what's the premise? How do we hook people in?
The premise is near future. And it's not a dystopian world, but it's kind of like our world further along into like surveillance and AI. And
it's like a Black Mirror episode.
Yeah, kind of. It's a Black Mirror episode. But it's action oriented because basically what happens is a terrorist with strange abilities starts kind of doing a series of violent attacks. And this investigator tries to figure out why she's doing it and to find and stop her. And there's a rabbit hole that they go down.
I love it. I've started the book. I've got a long flight coming up. So hopefully I can get through a big chunk of it. But go and check out the Stalguard Incident. Buy it. Thank you, Lynn. You're awesome. You. This has been fun. Anywhere else you want to send anyone apart from the book?
People can go to lynnalden.com. But yeah, I think they know where to find
me. They need to buy the book. They know where to find you. Yeah. Thank you, Lynn.